It's Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
Welcome to Legal Defense. I'm Casey Hoff.
And I'm Kirk O'Bear. Good morning, Casey.
Good morning, Kirk. We have a lot to talk about, including Mayor Rob Ford, Toronto's mayor, who's embattled in a whole bunch of different controversies. He was elected a number of years ago and has admitted just this week during a heated city council debate that he bought illegal drugs while in office.
Specifically crack cocaine, I believe he's discussing.
And he's acknowledged that he smoked crack cocaine while in a drunken stupor. This is before, but this is the first time that he's actually admitted to buying illegal drugs while he was in office.
You know, there is a video of this that has not publicly been released, at least not yet. And I think this is an example where, you know, Toronto's mayor, he ends up in a situation where he realizes something is about to happen and he goes ahead and
trying to get out in front of it.
Cuts bait instead of fishing.
But yeah.
There was another incident that was referenced in a recent article that I read where he was pounding his fists and shouting. And he also claimed that, well, that's just another situation where I was extremely inebriated.
Right.
And
right.
So this seems to be the defense that he's using for all of his actions is, don't worry about it, I was just insanely drunk.
Right. And he's got, you know, one of these situations where he also moved during this hearing where he was under essentially cross-examination by one of the city council members to ask questions about his, you know, whether he was using drugs or whether he was buying or selling drugs. And he later made a motion directing that all council members undergo hair, drug, and alcohol testing by December 1st. And I believe he offered to actually pay for it as well. So in a sort of a symbolic showing is saying, hey, don't come after me because all of you or many of you may have done drugs.
You know what else is interesting about this story, Casey, is that as recently as 2 weeks ago, the political popularity of Toronto's mayor was still at an all-time high for whatever reason. But earlier this week when they did a popularity poll of constituents in Toronto, he is now at a something 78% disapproval rating. So the tide has turned pretty quickly. But, you know, it's interesting that you and I have talked about this many times, but sometimes people that are holding a political office, whether it be a mayor or a governor or, you know, anybody else that's in the public light, and there are these issues that come up in terms of their aspects of their private lives that bleed over into their public lives. And, you know, it's interesting that we see a lot of initial denial in these types of things, and then later sometimes there's an epiphany of sorts where somebody is attempting to stand their own ground. And he's not stepping down, by the way. He's not, at least
right.
not
he's
as of
vowed
yet.
He's going to
maintain
stand his ground.
Stand his ground. And,
yeah.
and it's interesting because the procedure in Canada is very different than we have here. And there's very limited ways that the their version of the legislature, or at least within the city government, have to remove somebody in the position of mayor from office. What they've done is they've asked him to take some time off. You know, it's very, very Canadian, isn't it? Like, we'd yeah. like you to take a vacation. You know, we really want you to kind of have a chance to wrap your head around this whole situation. You know, take some time off. Take a little break.
Yeah.
In fact, that was the motion, was for him to, quote, take a break.
Well, and this is, you know, one of those things where he actually admitted to doing this while in office. And I think it's different than a politician who comes out and says, well, yeah, in the past I smoked marijuana or whatever the politician might say. That is, I think, different because you're not actually using drugs while in office. Now, we can debate whether it would be good to smoke crack while in office, and I think most people would say no.
Most people would say that.
That's
yeah.
not a good idea.
Are you suggesting it's a good idea? Or?
No, I'm
Because we could have that debate right now.
No, I'm not going to take that side of the debate.
Okay.
But I will tell you that before this all happened, Toronto police said in October that they had actually obtained a video of Ford apparently smoking from a crack pipe. And at that time, of course, Toronto police said, this is not enough to charge him.
Right.
And their version of, I don't know if they call them district attorneys or what they call them in Canada, but their version of the, you know, prosecutors
right.
said that they could not charge him. And the reason they couldn't charge him is because although they had video that they thought that it was him, Well, they don't have what it was he was smoking.
Right.
Right. They don't have the crack. And they didn't have any admissions from him. Well, now we have an admission from him, at least that he was smoking drugs.
Somewhere in the past 2 years, he's bought illegal drugs.
Right. He's bought illegal drugs. Yeah. So we don't have it as it relates to this specific incident necessarily. But the police spokesperson has said they're going to continue to investigate now. And it sounds like they're going to reopen their investigation or at least take another
look. You might
look.
Be a bit young to remember this, Casey, but do you remember a certain mayor of Washington, D.C. named Marion Barry?
Oh, of course I do.
That you were probably a toddler back then. But
oh, no, come on.
But it sounds remarkably similar, doesn't it?
I believe Marion Barry may still be in politics in some form or fashion. I think he might be a council member, if I'm not mistaken. I'm wrong about that.
Oh, is that true?
I believe so. So this is, this is one of those things where we have to gauge how we're going to judge politicians. And I think that the more and more politicians, and we've seen Anthony Weiner come out, we've seen all these people come out with allegations. Of course, Anthony Weiner's wasn't related to drugs.
Right.
It was related to, sexual escapades.
And it's interesting that you said we've seen Anthony Weiner come out.
Yeah, well,
and you didn't mean coming out.
Use of phraseology.
Yeah,
I just meant coming out with his admissions to doing certain things with a camera.
Yes. Right.
So we should be clear.
Well, let me ask you this, because I know how you feel about giving people the opportunity to rehabilitate themselves.
Yes.
Giving people chances, second chances, as it were. What do you think about this guy from your own perspective, and whether or not it's a good thing that he's admitted to his own shortcomings? Although he doesn't seem to think he has a problem, I think it's been also part of his statement that he has no alcohol or drug problem presently.
Well, I think that might be the issue, right? I mean, that's the problem, is that although he's making these admissions, he's essentially denying that he has a problem enough to step down. And if anybody has seen the videos, now I know you can't tell in somebody's totality from the videos that have been released, but it seems to me that a lot of the videos that have been released show him in a drunken stupor. And by the way, he's admitted to that.
And falling down.
And falling down and swearing
and
at people.
He's a big guy, too, and he had that initiative to for everybody in Toronto to lose weight, and he was going to take the first step, and he fell off of the scale.
Right,
because he lost his balance. That was another.
That could be problematic. But that's the other thing is there have been allegations that he's visited a house of prostitutes, and he's saying it's not a crack house.
That's a good defense. It's only a prostitute house. It's not a crack house.
Well, he actually said this is not a crack house. Have you been in that house? That's what he said. So those were his.
So not only is he asking everybody else to submit the hair samples and so forth, but he also wants them to go to the same prostitution house that he's been to.
Right.
To inviting them along.
Exactly. And it's generally a bad idea when you're accused of these things and you admit to these things to then lash out at other council members.
Okay, so it's really a different issue. It's really a different issue. It's not his drug use or his alcoholism necessarily. It's
denial.
It's his denial and it's his lack of honesty, lack of being forthright, reliability.
Yeah. I think so. And it calls into question whether he's fit to serve public office. Now, you're right that I certainly do believe in redemption, and that's fine. But that doesn't mean that you have the right to hold public office.
You know what's being
overshadowed? That's a different issue.
What is being overshadowed is whether or not the guy is actually a good mayor or not. Because, and I'm not defending the use of illegal drugs by any sense of it. And I'm not saying it's a good thing to go to work drunk. I mean, I hardly ever do that. I know you. No, you don't do it either.
But,
historically, there have been a number of well-known, very effective politicians that have had their own demons. I know that this week we've been paying a lot of attention to our former great president, John F. Kennedy. And, because it's now the 50th anniversary of his assassination, and of course there are many issues that are coming up in terms of discussing the true nature of his presidency. And he was a great man. He was a great leader. But I think that, it's a good example of somebody that had his own personal problems that, as long as they were under control to some extent and didn't turn into something that, that defined him as a person. Now, that's the problem with this mayor in Toronto, of course. Is
well,
that
the cover-up
turns
the
out
thing,
that right? Yeah, but, you know, there's absolutely no doubt, there's no debate even, that Kennedy was continued to have his weakness for women, various other women than his wife, which is rather surprising because, you know, Jackie Kennedy was seemed like, why would you ever cheat on her, you know? But
right.
But anyway, it's just well known. And it was known amongst people in his family, people in his administration, and so forth. I mean, there really is no mystery about that anymore. But we don't let that define him as a man. And there's also a debate that perhaps we, you know.
But had he come, I think there's a great parallel to be drawn here because you talk about Bill Clinton, right?
Sure.
Former president. The big problem for him was not necessarily that he had an affair with Monica Lewinsky, but it was that he denied that affair under, you know.
He didn't have relations with her. He never did have relations with her.
Yes, yes. And then he goes to try to define.
He just had
Right. So you draw that contrast, and Bill Clinton, in many ways, is defined by that.
Argue. Yeah, true.
I mean, maybe unfairly so, but he is. And I think the biggest problem for that was his statement about that. Whereas John F. Kennedy.
It never really came out. No.
Right.
It was more hidden.
So in Mayor Rob Ford's case, he's been denying this.
But
on and
you know,
on
my
on,
analogy was going to get to the point that we've had, perhaps not in quite as recent history, but you know, going back historically for, you know, well over 100 years, we've had people in office, including the office of president, that have had alcohol problems
and
other substance abuse problems. And, you know, to the extent that they were still effective leaders in doing their jobs, I'd like to see somebody address this man's capabilities, his accomplishments, his shortcomings in the context of actually mayoring. We'll be back right after these messages with more Legal Defense.
To Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
And welcome back to Legal Defense. I'm Casey.
I'm Kirk. What's next?
All right, Kirk, we're going to talk about Ryan Ferguson. He was a Missouri man who's been on the news a lot this week, and he was jailed for nearly 10 years for a murder that he did not commit. His release came this week after the Missouri Attorney General announced that his office will not retry Ferguson, who's 29 years old. According to CBS News, Ferguson spoke at a press conference shortly after his release, appearing before a whole bunch of media and supporters who clapped and cheered as he thanked his family, friends, and supporters. He said, quote, "I didn't know this morning I'd be standing here tonight. It was a very, very scary. It was very, very scary and daunting. I'm glad to be here. I want to thank the Attorney General for looking at the facts of the case and making decisions based off those facts and doing the right thing." So, you know, we applaud the prosecutor for doing the right thing.
The current prosecutor.
The current prosecutor should know. But last week, an appeals court throughout Ferguson's 2005 conviction in the killing of a sports editor, a news columnist essentially, the appeals court ruled that Boone County prosecutors in Missouri had violated federal law by failing to share several pieces of evidence with Ferguson's defense team during his trial. He, by the way, is not eligible for compensation from the state for his time that he spent in prison, because according to the Missouri Wrongful Conviction Compensation Statute, those eligible must have DNA evidence presented after their original trial in their favor in order to receive financial reimbursement from the state. So not only did he spend almost 10 years in prison, he gets no compensation for it, spending all that time.
Well, what's interesting about that statute is that obviously it's been drafted since the time that we've had DNA technology that can exonerate people. And I think the intent behind it is to provide a mechanism whereby there can be compensation where there's been a wrongful conviction. But where the statute falls short and where we have to address this nationwide, nationwide, by the way, because this was worse than DNA being present that could have, at a later point in time, exonerated somebody, because this was the willful act of a prosecutor that essentially decided on his own that he wasn't going to reveal this information to the defense because it might weaken his case. And looking back at the evidence that was withheld, it was clearly something that would have not only been useful for the defense, but pointed to another culprit. It just so happens that it doesn't involve, affirmative DNA evidence that exonerates him, but it is other evidence that clearly, in everybody's mind, including the existing, the current prosecutor in Missouri, is well convinced that this man is not guilty of the offense that he committed. Now, if I recall correctly from the news reports earlier this week, Casey, the prosecutor that originally was on this case faced criminal charges for his lack of candor and lack of contribution towards the we call it Brady material. And it comes
well.
From
that
the
was
case.
There was another case of Ken Anderson where the prosecutor did do a 10-day.
That's what I'm thinking of. Okay, yeah.
Yes.
It wasn't the same one.
It wasn't the same one, but and that apparently, and we'll get to that in a moment. Is
you're way ahead of me, man.
Is one of the first times. That's all right. Is one of the first times I think that's ever happened, at least according to some people in the industry.
And I wasn't necessarily going to tie the two stories together, but I did want to point out that I think that might be a more effective means of dealing with these wrongful convictions, because not only is this guy going to get nothing, but even if it was DNA evidence that would have exonerated him, there is a statutory cap on what people can get. And if you add it up, like, for example, here in Wisconsin, I know we're trying to change that. But, for people that exonerate—
$5,000 a year up to $25,000.
Right. What job have you ever worked where you earn $5,000 a year?
Not many.
And, how many people out there can— I know we're not talking about somebody having to provide for their own room and board or anything like that, but we're talking about the value of a year of your life that's no one can ever give back to you, and we're saying that it's only worth $5,000?
Yeah.
That's absolutely atrocious. So you know why it matters? Here's why it matters, Casey, because when we have prosecutors that are willing to charge these offenses and then to analyze the case like it's a game of chess and looking at trying to checkmate the other side by withholding important evidence or by manipulating testimony or by using all of their resources to obtain that conviction like it's some sort of trophy to be had. And when we always talk about how this is an adversarial system and how both sides have to fight hard. But let's face it, sometimes the prosecutor can do a better job of that because of the resources they have and because they're elected by people in many states to be in that position and to show off for the people of that state. I'm all revved up here, but I think it's absolutely viable and it should be a check against an abuse of power when a prosecutor can be subject to criminal prosecution for violating the rules of discovery and for willfully withholding evidence that would have been helpful.
And we know that can happen and did happen recently, and we'll talk about that, but you're right, it's very, very rare. Ferguson made, I thought, very simple but interesting point when he said, it's incredibly easy to get into prison, but to get out of prison, it takes an army, as you can see. Because he had all kinds of lawyers that he needed in order to try to prove up his case. And you think about all the other people out there who are not Ryan Ferguson's and who maybe don't have anybody to rely on. And of course, the Innocence Project, which does wonderful things, it can only help so many people, right? I mean, they can't help everybody.
Right. It typically consists of law students that are getting credit for the hours that they spend on
right, and I believe oftentimes not getting paid.
Oh, not getting paid at all.
And so it's one of those things that you definitely worry about, and I certainly
like,
lose sleep.
What if you were an innocent man sitting in prison and you'd been there for 10 years, and then somebody calls you up and says, "Yeah, I'm a law student, and I don't know anything about the law yet because I'm learning it, and I don't have a law degree yet, but I'm the only hope that you have for possibly getting out." And I'm not knocking the Innocence Project. They are definitely very courageous souls that are part of this process. But it's just unfortunate. You know what's really unfortunate is that we had to create the Innocence Project through volunteers and people that were willing to tap into resources that we're just lucky that we have. I mean, this isn't something that the government is providing as a stopgap or a safeguard, against wrongful convictions.
And it really should be.
Yeah.
It really should be, but it isn't.
It's unfortunate and it's a shame that we have to go to law schools and say, hey, do any of you that might be interested in justice want to take a look at some of these cases and see if you and not, don't get compensated for it. Don't, you know, you're not actually getting paid for anything, but can you devote your time and resources while you're trying to go to law school, by the way, and help out on these types of things? Then the people that act as directors for these programs or people that volunteer their time, nobody gets paid for any of it. It's just, you know, and this bothers me a lot, because if not for my conscience, if not for the fact that I care about my country and about my justice system that I live in, you know, there are many people that would still be serving sentences for crimes they didn't do. Absolutely. And there still are.
Absolutely. And this is one of those things, and it's one of those stories that just highlights this, but it shows that our system of justice, well, I suppose you could argue it one of two ways. It's flawed on one hand. On the other hand, thankfully he got out of prison and didn't have to spend the rest of his life there because of the actions of some very brave folks and courageous folks who went in to save his life. And he filed a petition for habeas corpus. And if you don't know what that is, that's sort of a legal term. But basically what it stands for is a proposition that once all of your appeals have been exhausted, once you can no longer appeal and the time limits have failed, you can still, this is your last out. This is sort of your only chance, right?
Right.
Of getting out. That's the simplest way. It's much more complicated than that. But that's what they use to try to get him out. Because there was this evidence that was it actually came to light later after the appeals process was over.
Right.
That this evidence had been withheld. And therefore, he was then released. But another story, as we continue with Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey, is the story of Michael Morton, a former Williamson County prosecutor named Ken Anderson, is headed to jail for a 10-day stay after he was found in contempt of court last week for hiding evidence that might have kept Michael Morton from wrongfully spending almost 25 years in prison for a crime that he did not commit. As part of the settlement with the state and the State Bar of Texas, that they formally reached, Anderson agreed to the jail term, a $500 fine, 500 hours of community service, and the loss of his law license. He had previously resigned as a district court judge in September, a position he held since 2002 after 16 years as Williamson County District Attorney. So while he was district attorney, during a 1987 pretrial hearing, that's how long this goes back, 1987, Anderson did not reveal two pieces of evidence that would have strengthened the case made by Morton's defense attorneys that a stranger had killed Christine Morton. Morton was later exonerated in 2011 after DNA testing on a bandana found near his home connected Mark Allen Norwood to Christine Morton's murder. Norton was convicted in March of killing Christine Morton, and he was sentenced to life in prison. So they found the guy. This guy spent 25 years in prison for a crime he did not commit. Why? Because there was evidence that was not turned over to him.
This is the story that I had been following more closely this week, and that's where I thought we were starting with this whole thing. But let me just point out that in the span of 10 days, we have two major stories that deal with, you know, essentially prosecutors not doing their job correctly. But you know, I think that this is a good precedent to set. I will take issue with one particular component of this. 10 days jail hardly equates to 25 years in prison.
Right.
And I think it's silly that we have somebody that's going to go spend 10 days in jail. Now, the loss of his law license is probably appropriate as well. But the point is, you know, we don't have an adequate way of really dealing with this. And I don't think that there's really any prosecutor out there that's going to say to him or herself that, gee, I better really follow these rules or else I might spend 10 days in jail. You know, that's just not enough in terms of what we expect, what we demand from somebody that has that much power to control somebody else's life. And if you go back to the beginning of this process, this dude didn't do anything against the law, but he lost a quarter century of his life. And
absolutely,
of course, we're not talking about even coming close to being able to pay him back for that. But somebody held the reins at the beginning of that process. Now, do you know that this same process, Anderson guy that's going to spend 10 days in jail, every step of the way during the appeals process, including the further testing of DNA that would have exonerated Mr. Morton earlier in the process, he objected to and fought it tooth and nail.
Right.
And, you know, it's even more deplorable.
Well, on that note, we've got some lighter-hearted subjects to get to.
Thank God.
We're talking about a lot of serious stuff. We'll be back. You're listening to Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey. Be back in just a moment.
It's Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
And welcome back to Legal Defense. I'm Casey Hoff.
And I'm Kirk Olberg. For those of you that may be first-time listeners, Casey Hoff and I are both attorneys that have a criminal defense practice. We focus exclusively in the area of criminal defense and traffic defense with our collective experience of well over two decades in the area of criminal defense.
Well, let's get into this topic now here. This is a story from Waukesha, Wisconsin, of course. A man recently called 911 and asked police, this according to Channel3000.com, to remove a woman from his bed because she was, quote, snoring like a train, end quote. I'm not sure exactly what that means, but the Smoking Gun reports, that was the website.
You mean the snoring like a train part?
Yes,
I think
yes.
He means loud.
Well, I understand that, yeah, but I mean, okay. it's a little weird. But
she was committing a crime.
Benjamin Duddles, 41 years old.
Disorderly conduct.
Yeah, right. Called Waukesha police in the early morning hours to say that he wanted a, quote, female removed from his bed, adding that he was, quote, not sure how she got into his apartment. After police arrived, he admitted that he had let the woman into his home voluntarily. The two drank together, had relations, and then fell asleep. They actually said it had relations.
Had relations. Well, see, we were just talking about former President Clinton before. I know what you mean by having relations.
Relations.
And it means more than sharing a cigar.
Exactly. Duddles, who police reported to be in an extremely intoxicated state when he called for help, then wanted her out of his bed because of her snoring. The woman reportedly suffers from sleep apnea. Police advised Duddles this situation was not a police matter since he had willingly let the woman into his home.
She apparently also suffers from drinking a lot and having relations with this guy.
Well, he actually has to be told by the police.
Sir, this is not a 911 call, sir.
It's like you've heard this all the time, but there are lots of people who apparently call 911 if they get their fast food order incorrectly given to them. You know, they don't get the cheese on the cheeseburger, right? And it's just, it's really...
I can see that making sense under certain circumstances.
Oh, yes, yes. There you go.
Let's say the employee won't give you your money back. And they say, you want trouble? I'll give you trouble. You're not getting any cheese on your sandwich, sucker. And then if you got a problem with it, call the cops. Okay, I'll call the cops.
First world problems.
Can't you
Kirk.
See? Can't you see how that might happen?
These are first world problems, right? there's also a story out of Oak Creek, Wisconsin. A pizza delivery driver. This is from TMJ4. A pizza delivery driver got quite a surprise while out on a delivery on Sunday. According to Oak Creek Now, the police employee showed up to an apartment on Timber Ridge Lane Sunday just after 12:30 a.m. when a man answered the door, mostly naked.
Mostly.
The man reportedly had a sock covering himself.
Just use our imagination?
Use your imagination. And the police money tucked inside of that sock.
What size sock was
it? Or the pizza
this?
Money, the police money.
I see what you're saying.
The pizza money tucked inside of the sock. I don't know the size of the sock, Kirk. You're asking way too many details about this. The delivery driver said that he left the apartment without delivering the pizza and that there were numerous people inside the apartment laughing. The employee did not want to press charges, but the apartment had been banned from any future deliveries from the company. He later told police that he meant it as a joke.
What charges? What charges would he be facing?
I don't know. Disorderly conduct, maybe,
he
right?
He wasn't exposing himself, apparently. He was just mostly naked.
Well, mostly naked, yes.
And he
still did have a sock covering himself.
Yeah, but, you know, and I was being a little facetious about the train snoring lady before, you know, engaging in disorderly conduct. But, you know, you and I have this debate often because we try to nail down exactly what disorderly conduct is, and it's like catching a slippery fish or herding cats. It's hard to say what it is because
right.
It's everything.
Right.
It's everything and it's nothing, and it's anything that bothers you. And if it bothers you enough to constitute a criminal charge, I suppose that's good enough. But, you know, it's one of those extra tools on the prosecutor's tool belt. You know, sometimes I picture a prosecutor like Batman with all these funny little gadgets, most of which don't really do anything. But this is like the grappling hook thing that they have to use once per episode just to justify its existence, you know, because otherwise he's walking around with this stupid grappling hook on his belt. And you'd have to wonder the logical question, why does Batman have this cumbersome tool on his belt? But the answer is that prosecutors have the ability to charge people with disorderly conduct.
Let's think about this. In real terms, I mean, seriously thinking about this, and I know it's hard to seriously think about this, a man standing naked with a sock over himself while having
you know, pizza money stuffed inside himself when the pizza guy comes. You know, what societal harm would we be protecting, or what part of society would be protecting by charging this guy with a crime?
Well, it happens all the time because, you know, I had a case not many years ago where a man was walking from his house to his garage in the country, well, out in the middle of the country, in a very rural area where maybe 1.2 cars drive by every hour. And a passerby noticed that he was au naturel in the process of doing so and called the police. And the police came out and gave him a citation for exposing himself. And I was able to...
Criminally charged.
He was criminally charged. And let's say, for example, I'm assuming that the pizza delivery place was a business, right? I mean, this was...
I assume so,
He didn't just call his neighbor and say, I'd like you to deliver a pizza to my house.
No.
So it's a business.
Right.
It might even have been one of those larger businesses that, you know, has a nationwide presence and is, you know, on par with, let's say, you know, McDonald's or something like that, only in the pizza area. I won't name specific names, but, you know, if there's a... I heard a joke recently that if you can name a male relative of yours, like Papa or Uncle, and then just any random name after that, like Jim, Jack, or Sam, you know, you've got the name of a pizza place, right?
Probably,
so, yeah. Uncle Sam's or something like that. That would be All-American Pizza. But, you know, perhaps it was a form of anti-commerce speech that the person was engaging in as a form of protest. Could you work with me on this?
Okay. All right. I'll go with you.
I thought you'd jump right on that because, you know, then we're censored.
No, I just don't think he should be charged because I don't see the harm to society.
I understand that. But do you think it's free speech?
Do I think it's free speech?
Sure.
Well, you know, probably not because we have laws, of course, that prevent you from walking down the street naked.
Right.
Because we have societal norms and standards for that type of
thing. What if it was somebody that what if it wasn't a one sock salute, but a one fingered salute? Would there be a difference in your mind?
Well, and he's naked?
Well, no, let's forget the naked part. Let's just say the guy answers the door and he gives the guy the old middle finger and then shuts the door.
Oh, well, yeah. I would think that would be freedom of expression.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Right. So what's the difference, really? I mean, isn't it kind of the same thing?
It's the difference between what we as a society consider to be, you know, the norms. And,
right.
and as you often point out, society has a right to make laws that conform with the norms of that society.
So it's normal to erect your middle finger, but not normal to
I would say it's a lot more normal. It's a lot more normal than using a sock.
Okay.
Because any highway or interstate in this country, and I would guarantee you right now there's somebody giving somebody the one-finger salute.
Yeah.
In a vehicle.
Right, right. You know, and I think our founding fathers would appreciate that because that was the genesis of having an opinion that you should not be afraid to express.
What if our founding fathers did do that?
I think so. I think we think about them as, you know, stodgy old men wearing white wigs and, you know, sniffing their powder snuff boxes and you know, with their quilled pens and their stocking feet and stuff like that. You know, I think that they had every bit of you know, an appreciation for the salacious, just like we might on our show.
Absolutely.
Know?
They didn't speak the king's English, right?
No, probably not.
Because they were trying to get away from that.
I really don't think so. Yeah, I think that they were probably just as normal as most people that
you
meet
today. Well, they were very rebellious.
Sure, very much so.
We know that.
Very much so.
And we appreciate that, right? Because we wouldn't probably have a lot of things we have today without that vigorous debate.
That's right. You know, you mentioned habeas corpus earlier in a different segment in the show. And, you know, I was just reading... Well, I've been reading it for a while because it's 1,800 pages long, but the book about Abraham Lincoln, Team of Rivals, and the whole philosophy as to why and how the president suspended the writ of habeas corpus for the first time in American history during the Civil War and the rationale behind that. And it's fascinating because the reason that we have that particular provision under the law is, as you've mentioned, a final safety valve, if you want to think about it, a final opportunity for somebody to address any issue that comes up in the context of what they believe to be a wrongful incarceration, so that it's not mired or burdened down by procedural issues. And that's really where we see a lot of these Innocence Project cases coming up, is that, well, you've got a good issue, Mr. Defendant, but unfortunately, this doesn't fit with any of the rules that we have. And although you may very well be innocent, we just don't care because, you know, it doesn't fit within some set of structural, procedural pigeonholes that have been created for that particular aspect of a criminal appeal. So it's designed to give people that, you know, an opportunity to address things on a more general level. Do you know how many writs of habeas corpus are granted? An infinitesimally small percentage. Yes. I think we got to take another break, I'm afraid.
But all right, we do. And of course,
how the time flies.
We will be back in just a moment with more Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey.
You're listening to Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
And welcome back to Legal Defense. I'm Casey.
And I'm Kirk. You know, Casey, I just wanted to say one other thing that I know sometimes we jump down each other's throats and we argue things, and you know that it's all an act, right?
Oh, I mean, of course.
You know that I'm just pretending. I actually have a great deal of respect for you, and I consider you to be not only an excellent attorney, but a wonderful friend as well.
Well,
but
you as well, Kirk.
You know, I don't want our listeners to get the wrong idea, you know, because they'll
go out and punch each other.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
No, absolutely. I feel the same way. Thank you, Kirk. And people getting into bad situations, of course, this is real stuff, right? We're talking about pardons and the governor forgiving somebody.
I know
and
where you're going with this.
That's a big topic this week. As a Marine Corps veteran, of course, we had Veterans Day, and we, of course, honor all our veterans, including Kirk. Marine Corps combat veteran Eric Pizer of Madison has commendations and medals, but feels his professional future hinges on something that's out of his grasp so far, a pardon from Governor Walker. This, according to WKOW.com in Madison. He says, it upsets me. He's 32 years old. He says, I was always told that everybody should get a second chance. During his military career, he was involved in two deployments in the Middle East and the war in Iraq. His first deployment was to Kuwait, where the fuel specialist supported vehicles in combat convoys. He volunteered for a second tour and was assigned to a base in Iraq where rocket-propelled grenades frequently landed near the barracks and buildings. As a corporal, he was responsible for a group of Marines, with all the members serving their first deployment in the war zone. He says, I felt it was my responsibility to look after those guys. And in 2004, while on leave back home in southern Wisconsin, he got involved in an after-bar fight. One punch, he said. Court records show Pizer's one punch badly broke another man's nose, requiring thousands of dollars in medical care. Pizer was convicted of a felony crime in Grant County and served a probation sentence. It's a former Marine's only criminal conviction, and he has satisfied the terms of his probation. He's also completed collegiate classes in criminal justice. His request for a pardon is one of more than 2,600 pending before Governor Walker. He said, I made one mistake. I paid for it. I've been doing everything I can to better myself. He has a goal, his career goal, of becoming a police officer. But the felony, of course, prevents him from ever owning a firearm again. And so that's what's possessing a firearm. That's what's preventing him from becoming a police officer. Now, just a little bit of background into this. The pardoning process has been part and parcel, and it's actually enshrined in our Wisconsin Constitution. And a pardon, people shouldn't get the wrong idea. The old version of a pardon sort of forgave you and erased the conviction. But the new version, and what Wisconsin ascribes to, does not get rid of the actual conviction. What it does is it restores rights. Now, we all know that when you get convicted of a felony, you lose the right to vote until your civil rights have been restored, which just means until you've served out your entire sentence, including probation or extended supervision, prison, whatever it is. And, of course, your right to vote is restored as well. But there are certain other rights
in Wisconsin.
That's not true
in every state. But
right, right.
True.
Exactly. Okay. I meant to say Wisconsin. But there are other rights that are never restored, such as your right to own and possess a firearm. That's one of them, among other things. Certain professions in the medical field that you can't work in, certain other careers that you can't do because by default, if you can't own or possess a firearm, you can't be considered to be a police officer because that's part and parcel of your duties.
Correct. So he's not working, working in certain financial institutions. In fact, most financial institutions, right, because they're insured by the federal government.
Right. And so what this guy is trying to do is he's asked for a pardon. Now, the governor has taken the position that he will not even consider any pardons in Wisconsin. Now, this is contrary to what both Republican and Democratic governors of past in Wisconsin have done. In fact, there is what we call the Pardon Advisory Board that's supposed to be set up that sort of filters through all the pardons and looks at them and makes recommendations to the governor. He hasn't appointed anybody to the Pardon Advisory Board and has indicated he won't do so. And his reasoning is because the people who have committed these crimes have been convicted and they're guilty, and so that's enough, and the justice system can do the rest. Well, that's not true without a pardon. And so we run into the situation where you have people who are worthy. We're not talking about people who have committed, you know, murder and you know, other homicide crimes and things like that. That's almost never considered in terms of pardons. We're talking about situations like this, where a guy served his country, made one mistake with one punch, and that's going to define the rest of his life.
Well, you know, the tragedy here is that it's not that the pardon wasn't granted. It's the refusal to even consider. And I think this case serves as a prime example of the fact that there are situations where even reasonable men can agree to disagree on whether or not somebody should have been prosecuted to begin with. But, you know, it's built into our system that this isn't a responsibility of the governor, not to grant pardons, but to consider them. It's part of the job description. It's part of what a governor does when they're elected. And for someone to walk into this scenario and say, I don't care who or what they did, I am not going to do my job that I agreed to do as part of my responsibilities. I'm not going to, execute my duties to even consider an application for what goal, for what reason? Because you have a simple understanding of what a governor does or doesn't do, because you have a pure real view of how the justice system works. Is that what it is, Governor
Walker?
Well,
here's the let me play devil's advocate with you for a second.
Okay,
and
go ahead.
Since we need to argue a little bit on this show. Let's say, in terms of this pardoning process, as you know, it's virtually unlimited in terms of a governor's power to pardon somebody.
Right.
He doesn't have to give a reason at all.
Correct.
And any reason is enough. He could say, I just like the way that the guy
looked at me. Guy's got a nice picture in his file.
Got a nice picture, so I'm going to pardon him. Now, here's devil's advocate position.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't that then open up the pardoning process to a political system whereby only the well-connected and well-to-do who have access, and by the way, there have been presidents who have been criticized for this,
oh, sure,
of the United States, because they pardon people who have connections to them politically or otherwise.
Can you say Gerald Ford?
And the least, yeah, and the less fortunate among us don't have any opportunity to get pardoned.
Well,
because of that political.
Here's
process.
What I would say in response to that: it's really one of many functions that any executive has. And if you can't isolate the pardon function, or at least the pardon discretionary function of considering pardons, you can't separate that from everything else that an executive does, because when it comes to appointment of people that are in particular government positions, or what sorts of bills will be signed or vetoed or anything like that, there's the same risk of there being political influence on it and people being connected enough. That's why we have, you know, a lack of support for a lot of things in our society, because they're not as politically connected. You and I were just discussing off the air before we went on the air this morning. You might find it hard to believe we got up that early, since we already have to be on the air at 8 o'clock every morning, every Saturday anyway. But we were just discussing how unfair it is, very unfair it is that we don't have a voice for the people that perhaps need it most in the situation to advocate for what may be at face value an unpopular position. And this is what's really wrong with just refusing as a matter of absolute blanket policy to consider any pardon. You know, you're setting yourself up for a ridiculous situation. If you're the governor, you're setting yourself up for failure here, because this is wrong. It's wrong for him to not consider it. I'm not saying the guy should have a pardon granted. I'm saying it's wrong for the governor to have a policy where he will refuse to even appoint a group of people that are supposed to be an advisory board on this.
Well, and
this
I agree with you, but let me again just play devil's advocate with you for one more time. If you have the situation where the governor, let's think about from his perspective, and I don't know exactly what it is, but I'm just guessing here. Maybe he doesn't want to pardon somebody in the off chance that they go out and do something again, and then it comes back to haunt him politically speaking. Because let's face it, this is a political process. It's you grant or deny a pardon by the governor's own word and
stroke
signature.
Of a pen.
The stroke of a pen. And so shouldn't we at least have, and when I say safeguards in place, shouldn't we at least have some safeguards in place that would prevent it from being a purely arbitrary process? So, for example, consent of the legislature, right? Just like we approve of or disapprove of a Supreme Court justice. I know it's a completely different scenario, but the president picks who he wants to nominate for the United States Supreme Court, and the Senate has to either confirm or deny them. That means, and the reason for that, I think, is so that he can't just pick anybody. They have to be somewhat qualified. Similarly speaking, the person who is up for a potential pardon has to at least be redeeming in some way or deserving of it in some way.
Well, I think that that's simply a function, Casey, of the fact that if we, as you've mentioned previously in this story, 2,600 pardon petitions pending, if we had to submit each and every one of those before both houses of our legislature, well, we would, you know, we have trouble enough passing a budget, you know, whether it's on the state level or worse yet on the federal level. You know, we're so busy having hearings on what day we're going to declare this to be. It's National Sliced Bread Day, you know, and every other thing that they do in Congress in order to, you know, to try and do their daily business.
I agree with you.
Then you get some sort of filibustering activity that occurs that stops all of it. But yeah, that is the answer. We're too busy, and it's unfortunate, but that's the answer. But I'll tell you what.
I can see your blood pressure going up.
What the remedy?
Very angry.
What the remedy for this? I am angry because this is sickening to me. It's absolutely sickening. And it's, and again, I feel for this guy. If I were the chief executive of the state, I would probably grant him a pardon if I knew more about it. But again, it's not whether he's getting it granted or not. They're not, the door is locked. It's not even there. It's a function of government that's been
you can't even be heard.
Sidestep.
Of course, you can join us every Saturday morning right here on 1330 WHBL from 8 to 9. You've been listening to Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey. Have a wonderful weekend.